Becca got to go to Woodleaf for a weekend retreat with Young Life, which is pretty surreal for me. I was walking up to the house with Becca, where all of the kids were meeting, and I saw Ken. Some of you know Ken. And Ken saw me. And we both realized what was happening in that moment. Because in 2001, almost 20 years ago, Ken was standing in front of Granada High School as I walked up to the school with my bag packed, ready to go to Woodleaf, the same camp that Beck went to this weekend. Woodleaf has a special place in my heart because it's the place where God's love first took hold of me. And I've shared this with you before in different ways, but it was at that camp, the message of love, of God's love demonstrated through Jesus that captivated me. Is this kind of love really possible? That was the question I spent the week asking. Now, according to Noel, the speaker that week, God's love isn't just words. God's love isn't passive. God's love isn't controlling. It isn't distant. But I heard that I am loved by God so much that Jesus came for me and for us. This love is so intensely personal. God's love is passionate. And driven by that love, God pursued me right in the middle of my sin and my rejection of him and all of my teenage angst. That week, I beheld for the first time the one who loves me in my entire being. And you know that my life has never been the same since. What has defined my life, though, has been this constant reminder. Not just one moment, but these constant reminders along the way that I am the beloved of God. That before I do anything, before I am anything, this is my identity. This is who I am. God's beloved. This is good news. It's been good news in my life. And so I wonder, like, have you experienced the beauty of God and his love for you? Do you know the ravishing love of the God of the universe? Can you see the one? Can you see him who delights in you? Who looks over you with delight and longs for you to be one with him? Can you see him? This is our morning. To enter into, to receive the love of our beloved. Song of Songs is going to help us get there. But we need to take a quick, not so quick, detour if we are going to be able to make sense of this strange book filled with sensual love poetry. I want you to imagine with me just a basic toolbox. In it, you have a variety of tools. You have a hammer and a couple screwdrivers and a handsaw and pliers and a level and a utility knife and a tape measure. None of those are important except for the hammer. We're not going to talk about any of the rest of them. You've got different tools for different needs. They all have their function. They have their place. They have their time. But I want you to imagine someone who never learns how to use any of the tools, but by default reaches for the hammer every time. You've maybe heard the saying before that it's tempting when your only tool is a hammer to treat everything as if it were a nail. So when you use only a hammer, the solution to everything becomes the same. Hit it, right? Sometimes harder, sometimes softer, You just hit it. You don't really have a lot of options. You got a hammer, so you hit the thing. That's your goal. You can imagine how unsuccessful this strategy to home improvement would be, right? Over the long term, just have a lot of broken stuff. But continue imagining with me here. Imagine that this person who only ever uses the hammer comes to realize that grabbing the hammer first for every project never quite seems to work out right. Right? And it seems to break more than it fixes. And so maybe the hammer isn't really good at all, maybe for anything. And so this person decides, you know what? I'm done with the hammer. The hammer has ruined enough stuff in my life. I'm done with it. And so it's time to set the hammer aside and learn the other tools. And over time, there's some success. All right, projects that used to get destroyed with the hammer now are coming together quite nicely when you use screwdrivers and pliers and other things. But as you can imagine, there's a new problem. See, having sworn off the hammer, eventually the hammer's forgotten completely. See, the person only remembers all of the damage created by the hammer. And so there are just many projects that get left uncompleted because a hammer would be the right tool for the job and you just don't have access to it. Can you imagine this bizarre, kind of silly scenario? Okay. Well, it's actually not that different from what has happened to the church when it comes to interpreting the Bible. So think about it. We have a toolbox filled with different tools for interpreting different kinds of passages. You use a different tool for a proverb than you do a parable, than you do law, than you do a narrative. You use different tools for each of these kinds of passages. For almost 1,500 years, there was a dominant tool that was used to interpret most of the Bible. It was the go-to tool for the church. Now, even though there was a whole toolbox available and there were people using other tools, this one tool was being used like the hammer in our earlier scenario. And over time, people began to realize that this tool for interpretation was being used inappropriately and actually harmfully. It had become the default tool for every passage, used when it wasn't really the best tool for the job, used when another tool would have been better. And so nearly 500 years ago, the church set that tool aside, abandoned it, and tried to forget it. The church decided that that tool had caused too much harm to the Bible and to Bible readers, and it needed to be left alone. And so, you know, for some time, we've been working with a toolbox with lots of great tools, but we've been neglecting a tool that could really help us out when used wisely. This morning, we are exploring the Song of Songs, a book that it turns out doesn't make a lot of sense when we use most of our regular tools. So open with me to chapter 2. This is where we start. We heard Andrew read from this passage earlier. This is probably the most popular verse. So if you've ever heard anything from Song of Songs, this is the verse. Although I know that some of you have never read Song of Songs before this week. And so you're welcome. You get to hear this twice now. In these verses, we have a woman who is longingly celebrating her man. And so we start in chapter 2 and we'll start in verse 8. And we hear this poetry, this love poetry between a man and a woman. We hear the voice of my beloved. Behold, he comes, leaping over the mountains, bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, there he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, looking through the lattice. My beloved speaks and says to me, Arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away. For behold, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth, the time for singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The fig tree ripens its figs, and the vines are in blossom. They give forth fragrance. Arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away. This is the word of the Lord. But how? Right? How is this the word of the Lord? What could this poem possibly be saying about God? See, among our tools for interpreting the Bible, most of the tools that we are familiar with are designed to help us answer a few basic questions. You'll recognize these if you use our small group studies, right? What does this passage say? What does this passage mean? And how should I respond to this passage? These questions are pretty straightforward. These questions help us explore what a biblical author intended to communicate in a passage. They help us to understand what the passage might be telling us about who God is and who we are and what God's plan or purpose is in the world. And these questions help us understand how we might live well in God's world. And as we've discovered over time, as we've studied different books of the Bible, that it's much easier in some passages to answer these questions. Like we just read Proverbs. It's way easier to figure out what should I do after reading Proverbs. But some books are much harder, and we've struggled through some of the prophets and some of the more challenging texts. But then you come to Song of Songs and you realize, like, these questions, what does the passage say? What does the passage mean? How should I respond to the passage? Can't be answered in a way that helps us. When we try to figure out what this poem says, like when we just ask, like, what does it say? Like, literally, is a series of love poems between a man and a woman. A man or a woman expressing love one to the other. To be more specific, I mean, the book is often broke up, depending on who you're reading and who's kind of looking at it, into several different poems. Some readers see a narrative progression from one song to the other. Others see a series of repeated cycles in them, but still some don't even see much connection between any of them at all. And then as you read it, as you like dig in, as you like notice the details, there are fascinating details within the poetry if you're asking the question, well, like, what does it say? For instance, one of the interesting details is that it's the woman in this passage who is most often seen as pursuing the man. There are several extended sections where the two can be heard celebrating various body parts on each other, referring to Nex's towers, which sounds weird to us, but apparently was noteworthy in an older day. There are obstacles that keep getting in the way of the love of this man and woman being together. Throughout the book, you find repeated phrases. You hear the refrain, a warning about awakening love before it's ready. You hear the declaration that ran through each of our passages this morning, declaring, I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. Also, we find that Solomon is named in this song, which is interesting to us. We've spent time with Solomon over the last couple months. But it's interesting, the woman is referred to as the Shulamite, which is a feminine version of the name Solomon. And we're given this sense that these two are compatible and equals with each other in some dynamic way. And so you can see there's some fruitfulness, there's some interesting observations as you make your way through and you answer the question, like, what does it all say? But the conclusion is the same. In its plainest sense, this is love poetry between a man and a woman. The further you dive into the details, the more it is just that, an expression of sensual love between a man and a woman. Which brings us to a really important question. Why in the world is Song of Songs in the Bible? I saw some shoulders chuckling as that's the anticipated question. Like, why is this book in the Bible? Like, when you read it, you immediately recognize Song of Songs doesn't give us anything to do. Right? You read it over and over. There's no thing for us to do. In this way, Song of Songs is definitely not the book of Proverbs. But then we also discover that it doesn't really give us much to like think deeply about either. And so Song of Songs also is nothing like the book of Ecclesiastes. If you remember last week, I suggested that the book of Proverbs teaches us how to love God with all of our strength, and Ecclesiastes teaches us how to love God with all of our minds. Song of Songs is clearly not like either of those books. And yet Song of Songs is included among the wisdom books that are associated with Solomon. Do you know that traditionally, historically, Song of Songs has been understood as a book of wisdom? It's weird, right? But treating it as a book of wisdom with the tools that are left available to us, Song of Songs has often been interpreted as a positive expression of the intimacy that God intended between Adam and Eve in the garden. Simply, that's it. Song of Songs is a positive expression of the intimacy that God intended between Adam and Eve in the garden. For most of the last 500 years, the church has seen this as the Song of Songs' purpose and value in the Bible, a wise reminder that God made sexual intimacy as a good part of his creation. That physical intimacy is an important part of marriage, and that amidst all of the biblical commands and stories warning against the dangers of this sort of intimacy, it really is good. It really is intended from God, an intended gift from God. Whole books have been written by Christians and by pastors using Song of Songs as almost like a manual on marriage intimacy. Contrast this with some of the earliest Christian writers who wrote commentaries and dozens of sermons on the song, who never once treated this book as a guide to marital intimacy. And also consider this. If this is all the book is, a celebration of God's gift of sex, then what value does this book have for those who are single in the church? For those who are divorced or widowed? Why would God give the church an entire book that is inaccessible or irrelevant for a large number of people in the church? Maybe Song of Songs isn't just about how to love your spouse better, but maybe Song of Songs is about how to love God with your whole heart. And maybe better yet, Song of Songs is about how deeply loved we are by God. I say that, but our normal tools for interpreting Scripture can't help us get there. We need to find a really old tool. And some refer to this old tool as allegory. Others have called it spiritual reading. And still others have called it reading beneath the text. All of these point us in the same direction, which is to say, not all scripture carries its meaning on the surface or in the plain sense of whatever is written. There is sometimes truth lying beneath the text. But if the tools that we have available only ever help us see what's in the text, then you can see where our problem is, why we have such a hard time with a book like this, because we can never get beneath. But hopefully, you can already see the danger of getting beneath the text. Right? If you start to say that there is another layer of meaning beneath what is written, then there is the constant danger that exists for the church and a danger that the church experienced for 1500 years, that we will keep finding hidden meaning that doesn't really exist. We'll find meanings that are really convenient for us. We'll find meanings that aren't appropriate readings of what's there. And so we have to be careful to use our hammer only when working with nails. And we have to be careful only to read beneath the surface of the text when it's called for. So if you're still open to chapter 2, look down at verse 16 with me. Here's the classic line. My beloved is mine and I am his. My beloved is mine and I am his. A spiritual reading of this text presses past the man and the woman. And it recognizes that Song of Songs was included in the Bible because in the beginning, God made the man and the woman united in perfect intimacy, spiritual, emotional, physical unity. And he did that to image or reflect his own character into the world. God made the woman and the man united in perfect intimacy, spiritual, emotional, and physical, to image or reflect the character and the nature of God into the world. This is such an important piece of the story for us. See, the Bible never talks about physical intimacy as an end in itself. The Bible shows us an intimacy that was created to point to a deeper intimacy. The intimacy that God experiences within himself, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and also the intimacy that God expects to share with us as he brings us into his life, into his unity, into his life. This is the deeper intimacy for which we were made and for which the intimacy between a man and a woman points us toward. Abide in me, we hear Jesus say. Remain in me and I will remain in you. Jesus is offering this picture of branches intimately connected to a vine to depict this intimacy with him and intimacy with his Father that we are brought into. The scriptures tell us that we are those who are loved by God. For God is love. And God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. And so we can hear in the Song of Songs the passionate words of a woman. My beloved is mine and I am his. And we can immediately begin to encounter a deeper truth. That the life-defining love shared between a woman and a man is just a taste of the richer, deeper, more satisfying love between God and his people. What this reminds us of is that any time we settle just for the intimacy that exists between people, it's like being invited to a feast, a banquet, getting a taste of what's to come. Be like, I might get around to going to the feast sometime. Settling for this taste. It's not just that the man and the woman in this story, in this poem, love each other. But can you hear how they define themselves? They are defined by this love that they have for each other and that is reciprocated. They identify themselves by this love. I am the beloved of my lover. And this is so much more true of us with God than it could ever be with another human being. Human marriage is like a shadow. Human marriage is like a shadow, giving us a faint outline of the fullness of love found in relationship with our God. This is how to read spiritually, recognizing that the plain words are pointing to another reality, reading beneath what is written. But as we've already pointed out, there's the ability to misuse the hammer. And so look at the very next lines. We read in verse 16, it continues, he grazes among the lilies until the day breathes and the shadows flee. Turn, my beloved, be like a gazelle or a young stag on cleft mountains. If there is a deeper reality behind the man and the woman lovers, well, then it would be easy to assume that, well, there's a deeper reality to every word that appears in the text, every image that shows up. And so we could go on this endless hunt for meaning where there is no meaning. Grazing among the lilies isn't a spiritual way of saying something else. The day, the shadows, the gazelles, these aren't symbols for some other sort of spiritual thing. All we're meant to do as we read this poem is picture a man who poetically is described taking his sweet time as he enjoys the gift of his beloved. If you can imagine one of these animals patiently grazing in the field, there's a patience, there's a nurturing that happens in this relationship. This is poetic. This is the poetry in the text doing its work. But we also discover the poetry reveals that this love has made this man full of life and strength and energy like a gazelle or a young stag. This isn't some deeper meaning beneath the text. This is just the poetry that's in the text. But when you think about a man who is in love in this way, whose love makes him full of life and strength and energy, and who is pleased to take his time in the midst of his love, that should point us toward the love that God has for us. Can you imagine God loving you in this sort of way? Loving us in this sort of way? Turn with me to chapter 8. We'll look at our kind of the final part of this passage. And I want you to hear, starting in verse 5, we hear this question asked, who is that coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? Under the apple tree, I awakened you. There your mother was in labor with you. There she who bore you was in labor. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. For love is strong as death. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. If a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, he would be utterly despised. Let me try to point us toward a spiritual reading of this passage. Who is that coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? Under the apple tree, I awakened you. What could this possibly mean? Well, from the larger story of the Bible, we recognize this imagery. It's familiar imagery. And we remember the beginning of the story. Can you recall Adam and Eve being born? Their lives under a tree. The two of them eating from a fruit tree. And there, they found themselves expelled from the Garden of Eden. And where did they go? But into the wilderness. And so the story of the scriptures is one long tale of God's people lost and wandering in the wilderness. And yet, who is that coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? If the beginning of the story is Adam and Eve eating from a fruit tree and being exiled into the wilderness, how does the story end? Well, the book of Revelation comes to a close with Jesus bringing his bride into heaven from the wilderness. And there is another tree, the tree of life, the tree whose leaves are for the healing of the nations. And we find the bride on the arm of the beloved, restored and brought out of the wilderness and into life. You can hear the story, right? We hear it here. And we wonder, how is this possible? Because the wilderness is a devastating place. We know, don't we? We live in the wilderness. We live in the wilderness. We live in the place of trial and turmoil and tribulation. We live in the wilderness where death tears apart our lives constantly, where there is pain all the time. We live in the wilderness. And yet we hear, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm, for love is as strong as death. Jealousy is as fierce as the grave. And we come into contact with a lover whose love is more powerful than death. A lover who enters into the wilderness with us. If you think about where the story started, it started in the garden. Adam and Eve rejected the lover of their souls. And they went into the wilderness. But he went into the wilderness after them. This is the great story of the scriptures, that every time we resist the Creator, every time we choose the wilderness over the garden, we find ourselves in the wilderness, lost, and our lives in turmoil. And again, the story is the same. The Creator follows us. The beloved enters into the wilderness with us and carries us through. And we long for that day when he carries us into our new home forever, where we enjoy him under a tree, where there is life and love and intimacy. And the beautiful thing is, as we're in this wilderness, the Creator's not still in the garden. The Creator's not waiting for us in the future garden. The Creator is here. Our beloved has come to find us here and now. Can you hear the voice of the beloved today? Because he is with us. And he is announcing it again. You are my beloved. Can you receive that truth this morning? Can you receive the truth? Can you stand in your identity as the beloved daughter, son of the Most High God? No matter what anybody else says, no matter what the wilderness tries to say to us, of course, the enemy also lives in the wilderness and will say to us, are you really God's daughter or son? Are you really loved by the Father? You are, more than you ever will know. And so today, will you receive that love again? We'll come to the table together to remember the extent of that love, the lengths to which our beloved will go to bring us into the garden again.